Get ready to rock. Radio.
And we're saying a very warm welcome to Chester, to a guy who I remember from the golden era of the late 80s, early 90s. Welcome to Get Ready to Rock, Dan Reed.
Thank you. It's an honour to be here.
Oh, it's nice to talk to you. Now, you've just seen this promotional copy I've got of Slam, which goes right back to the late 80s.
89, yeah.
Yeah, 89. And it's possibly the album that you're best known for in the context of Dan Reed Network. And if I can just read out some of the promotional blurb in the cover here. What they're saying is they're calling him the new Prince, a rival to Bon Jovi, a man with a sound like INXS, but Dan Reed is definitely the most explosive new talent in funk rock whose live act is blowing away all rivals. How did it feel back then, Dan, for you?
In one way, to read that stuff when you've been a musician that's been... Your goal was to become a rock star in a way. You know, I grew up on a farm in South Dakota listening to Cheap Trick songs on the tractor radio, and I just couldn't wait and to be on a big stage and play in front of thousands of people. That was a dream of mine since I was a kid. So reading stuff like that back then, it was definitely fed the ego, and it was nice to read, but it was also a tremendous amount of pressure that I didn't expect that effect to have come on so strongly. And that was also the time period where I, right after that, statements like that is when I shaved my hair off and tried to really just kind of change the direction of the network for the Heat record, which came out third, as the third album, and tried to become more political with that. Or even if we were talking about sexual stuff, it was tongue-in-cheek maybe, or pointing a finger at our infidelities, our brazen promotion of just doing whatever we want, whenever we want. Songs like Life is Sex and Blame It on the Moon. Those are all in the Heat, but I think those were all me trying to kind of battle the pitfalls of what I was seeing in the rock industry.
Because actually that's an album, Dan, that I must admit I overlooked at the time. Maybe because you did break up shortly after that. Mm-hmm. This is the album, The Heat, I think came out around about, was it 1991?
One.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I did buy your early albums. I have to say the Dan Reed Network album, which came out in 1988,
yeah.
Which I don't think was your first album, was it? I think there was one before that.
Yeah, we did it was an EP. We did a record called Breathless, which was 1985 or 6.
Right.
Maybe 86.
Yeah. Yeah. But actually that first, if you like, the first major album, which was the Dan Reed Network.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really a very strong album that possibly gets overlooked when people look at Dan Reed Network. They tend to home in on Slam, I think, really, as the big one.
Hmm.
How do you feel about that? I mean, what do you think is your strongest album in that period?
I think they're all stronger for different reasons. I think the first album was quite innovative in mixing synthesizers and rock guitars. We also used drum machines for a lot of percussive parts, but we also had live drums on every song as well. Songs like Get to You or Taming the Wild Nights, I'm So Sorry, a bunch of different tracks where we were making friends with technology. And there wasn't a lot of bands doing that in the way that we had done it at the time. So I like that record for that reason. I think it's a fidelity-wise, it's amazing, the first
yes.
album. Song-wise, I can never really comment on the songwriting because to say one song is better than the other is, I don't know, as an artist you should never really get on a high horse and think your music is good. I think it's best to think that you always suck and that way you always strive to write better all
yes.
the time.
Well, was that very much the sound of the band, even before you got a big-time producer and a big label?
Yeah, well,
was it always that funk rock sound?
Yeah, we were pretty much big fans of Sly and the Family Stone, but also Cameo, also INXS, also Aerosmith. We were big rock and roll fans and big funk fans, mm-hmm. all the band members. And so when we were playing, I think it was really the sound of our band was born out of playing 5 or 6 nights a week for a couple years before we got noticed by any label, and having to play at clubs where we wanted people to dance. We also wanted people to like think a little bit about the lyrics and melodies, not just do, you know, funk grooves all night. And that that forced us to be melodic and write songs and not just disco tracks or something. So that's where the sound was born, out of wanting to play as much as possible and make the audience just, you know, get their groove on, but at the same time make the songs memorable.
Yes, it was very much like that. And I should mention to listeners that the first album, the first major album, let's say, that was produced by Bruce Fairbairn, wasn't
yes.
it? Who produced Slippery When Wet for Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
So we're talking big time stuff here, aren't
yeah.
we, in the late 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, from what you said at the start of our chat, you sort of reacted against that, which you must have lived, the big rock and roll lifestyle, the big budgets, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of promotion going on for the band.
Yeah.
So it's great to have been through that
yeah.
process, but you came through it with finally the Heat and then the band split up. Now,
yeah.
well, what was the reason for the breakup of the band? Was it
well,
any one reason or was it natural progression?
It wasn't natural progression. It just was me coming off the Rolling Stones tour. We had just done like 27 dates with them around all of Europe. And I had seen the height of rock and roll status, the highest you can get. I mean, if the Beatles were still together, I guess, you know, at the time, that would have been okay. But I think the illusion that I had created of, you know, where you can get with this, the bubble popped for me. And I realized that if the network was to become that big of a band, not as big as the Stones, let's say, but big in the moment, like Bon Jovi or something, that there's a tremendous amount of responsibility and power that you wield there as not only as an artist, but as somebody with a lot of cash in your pocket. And it can either feed your soul and turn you into a person that's trying to help the direction of the human race, the way Bono has done it, I think. Or it can turn you into a mansion buying madman. And I wasn't sure which direction I would head with that. I wasn't a balanced person at the time as much as I tried to be. I wasn't into drugs and alcohol or anything like that, but I definitely had some issues with where I wanted to go with this newfound, you know, people making comments like that. I realized, wow, I can really do something with this,
mm-hmm.
or I can destroy with that energy and power. So I decided to back out completely and make it really easy on everybody to, I wasn't either going to be a changing rock and roll or I wasn't going to be a parody of myself. I decided to just walk away.
It's an amazing decision, that, really. I mean, also the musical climate wasn't great for sort of melodic hard rock bands. We had grunge, didn't we, in the 90s? And
yeah.
I'm sure that must have come into it. I mean,
yeah, well, yeah. We were just talking about that. You're exactly right. That's another reason. You asked if there's one reason. There was about five or six that all kind of folded in together. One is I was really tired of being on the road, living in a hotel and not having a garden or a dog or just a normal life. The other thing was the grunge scene. A lot of these bands from Seattle were acquaintances, semi-friends, I would say, some of the guys. And they were all just coming up when the network was, we got our record deal. We were playing in Seattle, and I used to see Lane Staley from Alice in Chains at our shows, and the guys from Mother Love Bone, which became Pearl Jam, used to come to our shows. And they were all really beautiful, sweet musicians on their way up. And when that scene broke, I realized, wow, this is music. This is like real serious, hard, funking rock music with serious lyrics. And the network had one foot in that direction and one foot in the other direction. And now I see why I quit now, because I see a Rock of Love TV show with the lead singer from Poison looking for his wife on national TV. And I'm like, that could have been me,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
had I
you
become a millionaire,
right decision, yeah,
you
no,
know,
yeah.
I mean, I could have gone that way.
Mm.
I could have tried to go the Bono way, but I wasn't sure what I would do.
Mm.
And the grunge scene smacked me upside the face and said, Dan, you know, you either need to get really, really serious with what you're doing, or you need to take a break. And I chose to take a break.
Get ready to rock radio.
In regard to Dan Reed Network, did you ever get back together again in the time since you broke up? So,
well, we did do one Swedish tour. I think that was in 93.
Oh, right.
We played like
yeah.
10 dates or 15 dates up there. But that was pretty much the last thing that we did, yeah.
And do you see yourself ever getting back with these guys again?
I was just asked that question earlier. I don't foresee that because I'm not a fan of trying to recreate the past. I'm playing some of the Network songs now on acoustic guitar, but only because it, two reasons. One is that people want to hear those songs. The second reason is that I'm liking reinventing them and breaking them down to their basic core, melody, lyric, chord changes. That's it. No synthesizer sounds, no big bang boom, no lights, da 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 da. And to me, that is worthy of trying to do. If the Network was ever reformed to play, it couldn't be for the reasons that a lot of bands are doing tours now, is to pay their bills. They come out and recreate their clothes, recreate their whole vibe, the old set lists, and try to recreate the sound. And to me, that's like, I don't know, it's like eating
really
at McDonald's every day.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I know
yeah. As an artist, we should try to reach for a little higher ground than that.
So we should say at this point that although we tend to think of you as, and you were the front man of the band, mm-hmm. you also played guitar, didn't, and you wrote...
I wrote, the majority of the Damien Network songs. There was a few songs that were co-writes with the band members, but and that's, you know, strictly my fault. I mean, all those other guys wrote. I mean, Blake wrote music, Melvin wrote music, Brian James wrote songs, I would say, you know, lyrics and music. And they would present stuff all the time, but I was just such a control freak at the time that I very rarely let their music in the doorway because I had just so many ideas myself and I wanted to flesh them out. And hence, that's why the band was called the Dan Reed Network as opposed to just the Network, because I was coming up with 99% of the material at the time.
That's interesting.
But that's, you know, once again, I came up with 99% of the material on purpose and guided it that way. So
yes.
That wasn't really fair to the other band members, and perhaps the Network could have been even a better band had I been more open-minded with that stuff.
Yes.
But we did what we did.